In the fall of 2002, I found myself speeding down a two-lane desert highway. Smoke blocked out the California sun as flames lined both sides of the road, inching closer and closer in my path. I was on my way back from a camping trip when the Williams fire threatened to cut off my path home. I couldn't recall experiencing a fire of this magnitude. For days, the sky in the area was reddish-brown and everything was covered in ash. From September 22nd to October 7th, 2002, that fire burned 38,094 acres and destroyed 77 structures. It was the third largest of the 2002 California wildfire season, in which 8,171 wildfires burned a total of 538,216 acres. The United States had long feared such destruction from fire. During World War II, fire was considered a potential weapon of war. In 1942, a Japanese submarine shelled an oil field near Los Padres National Forest, sparking concerns about fire on the home front. In response, the War Advertising Council and the U.S. Forest Service launched a public awareness campaign to warn about the threat of fires. Resembling wartime messages, early ads read, quote, "Another enemy to conquer, forest fires." And one poster said, quote, "Our carelessness, their secret weapon," which was accompanied with an image of Hitler peering down on a blaze. They even used a familiar face for messaging, Disney's Bambi. And the public started listening. This success inspired the creation of a cartoon bear sporting a Ranger's hat and dungarees, Smokey the Bear. In August 1944, he first appeared pouring a bucket of water on a campfire and saying, "Care will prevent 9 out of 10 fires." In 1947, he received his better-known tagline.
"Remember, only you can prevent forest fires."
Smokey's campaign was effective. Between the 1930s and 1950s, the average number of wildfires in the U.S. decreased significantly. By 2011, the annual acreage burned had dropped from 22 million in 1944 to just 6.6 million. However, some scientists are now finding that the strict suppression of all fires, an idea Smokey's campaign reinforced, may have made some forests more vulnerable to large wildfires. Historically, 4.4 to 11.9 million acres of California's forests burned annually, much more than today. Before European settlement, Native Americans regularly used controlled burns to manage the landscape and prevent devastating wildfires. Government policy has evolved to reflect this knowledge, with controlled burns now being used to manage forest fuel and reduce the risk of larger uncontrolled fires. This was exemplified in 2001, as Smokey's message was subtly updated to "Only you can prevent wildfires," acknowledging that not all fires are harmful. Yet, wildfires have grown more frequent and intense in recent years. Since the 2010s, climate change has exacerbated conditions, leading to longer fire seasons, more severe fires, and higher costs. California, in particular, has been hit hard. In 2020, over 8,100 fires burned nearly 4.5 million acres, a dramatic increase from 2002. The economic impact has been staggering, with insurers like State Farm and Allstate halting new home insurance policies in high-risk areas, leaving residents vulnerable. The environmental toll is also severe. A 2023 study revealed that 58% of the land burned in recent years occurred between 2020 and 2021, impacting habitats of over 50 species. In addition, the increase in wildfires is causing a harmful cycle. The carbon dioxide from the fires adds to global warming, which leads to hotter, drier conditions making the land more prone to future fires. Without intervention, the risk to lives, ecosystems, and property will only continue to grow, fueled by a changing climate and unsustainable land management practices. Now, back in 2008, the California wildfire season was one of the worst of the 21st century up to that point, burning nearly 1.6 million acres. For the first time since 1977, the U.S. military assisted in the fight as Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger deployed 400 National Guard troops. He noted that the sheer number of fires had overwhelmed the state's firefighting resources.
Right now, well, I think that we have seen last year that the normal fire seasons, the way we have known it in the past, that is pretty much gone. Luckily, we have everyone working together, but I'm very concerned because when you hear those reports, like I've heard last night, I was very concerned because you see there's 700 fires and they're very close to one another. And so the danger was that for them to join.
As wildfires become more destructive, the need for climate action becomes increasingly urgent. With backwards momentum on environmental policies during the Bush administration, a welcome change came in 2008 as both U.S. presidential candidates, John McCain and Barack Obama, took positive positions on the environment and climate change. Both recognized climate change as a critical issue, with each advocating for action. Obama called it, quote, one of the biggest challenges of our time, end quote. And McCain proposed a plan to build nuclear power stations as part of his energy strategy. While both supported cap and trade to reduce emissions, Obama targeted an 80% reduction by 2050, compared to McCain's 60%. However, environmental issues took a backseat to economic concerns in the election, with climate change often overshadowed by a financial crisis that upended the globe.
Trading at 16.
What the heck is going on down here? I don't know.
All of a sudden here, we started hearing screaming.
$1 billion bailout plan sending shockwaves through Wall Street. The bailout plan was voted down.
Lehman Brothers is going bankrupt. And financial markets from Asia to Europe are doing their utmost to prevent Monday from turning from dark to black.
But now it's official, we are in a recession.
I'm Demetrius Lynch, and this is Going Green.
One of my proudest moments is when I looked at Barack Obama in the eye and I said, Mr. President, you will not fill this Supreme Court vacancy.
Why would you put in something on emissions reductions on climate change to oil refineries in a highway bill?
If we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually.
In episode 8, we highlighted the geopolitical and corporate influences on environmental discourse in the U.S. through the late 1990s and 2000s. I examined a pivotal moment for President Clinton's administration as it faced mounting pressure in the lead-up to the UNFCCC's COP6 conference, a push for emission targets and stronger energy standards, the Bush administration's deep ties to the oil industry, a disaster that led to severe environmental and economic damage, and highlighted the failure of egregious deregulation and significant environmental rollbacks. If you haven't listened to that episode, I encourage you to go back and listen to all the episodes of this series in order. Today, we'll examine the Obama administration's environmental policies, the impact of the Supreme Court's Citizens United ruling, and the Trump administration's impact on U.S. climate policy and global efforts. And I'll get into all of that after the break. Episode 9, This Is Fine.
It's really wonderful that people were out here on the sidewalk in Times Square applauding just and watching, and it was really great.
I'm so glad to witness the first black man accepted Democratic presidential. I am so glad. I'm so glad I can tell my son, yes, you can become president. Yes, you can change the world. Obama, I love you. The time for change is now. November 4th, I'll be the first one in the voting booth to make sure that change happens.
Inspirational. He's got a lot of good ideas. I just would like to have heard how he was going to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. I didn't hear him say how he planned to do everything he wants to do. I was really impressed with the fact that he feels education is so important. I'm a registered Republican, and this is the first election where I'm listening to the Democrat.
November 4th, 2008. The energy across the United States and even the world was palpable. Citizens in the U.S. lined up at polling stations across the country in record numbers to cast what could be a historic ballot to decide between presidential candidates Barack Obama and John McCain. Candidate Obama ran on a message of hope and change that swept the nation. The change was a deep desire to move on from the partisan politics born in the 1990s. The hope was personified in Obama himself, the first African American to be elected president of the United States, a country with a rich history of disenfranchisement, civil rights abuses, unconscionable treatment, and enslavement of people who looked like him for over the last 400 years.
Hello, Chicago! If there is anyone out there who still doubts that America is a place where all things are possible, who still wonders if the dream of our founders is alive in our time, who still questions the power of our democracy, tonight is your answer.
Barack Obama was elected by a wide margin that evening and began his tenure as the 44th President of the United States on January 20th, 2009. During his first term, the fallout from the astonishing economic collapse in 2008 and incredibly persistent congressional opposition would prove a formidable challenge, particularly derailing many climate goals and promises. President Obama's climate legacy is characterized by significant achievements as well as some missed opportunities. In his first term, Obama's climate policy mirrored that of George W. Bush, marked by efforts to avoid greenhouse gas regulation as the administration prioritized the economic recovery, healthcare, and contended with the political consequences of those policies. With the economy in disarray, Obama signed economic stimulus legislation in February 2009. In part, it did include nearly $37 billion for clean energy research and development at the Department of Energy. 4 months later, with failing car companies seeking a federal bailout, the Obama administration proposed higher fuel efficiency requirements and the first greenhouse gas standards for passenger vehicles. The regulations, which took effect in 2012, were expected to nearly double the average fuel efficiencies of vehicles by 2025. He followed up that action by granting a Clean Air Act waiver to California in 2013, allowing the state to set emission standards for vehicles that exceeded federal regulations. This move effectively made California's stringent standards the national benchmark, as automakers had already decided to comply with California's rules across their entire fleet. While this was a victory for climate action, the credit goes more to the existing momentum and efforts in California. Initially, the Obama administration focused on green jobs over direct major climate change action. In April 2009, the White House climate and energy czar advised environmentalists to emphasize energy independence and green jobs rather than global warming, based on polling data that suggested Americans were more receptive to economic benefits than warnings about climate change. Polling had shown that while most Americans generally believed in climate change, they were not inclined to support legislation based solely on scientific warnings. This strategy faced criticism as it downplayed the existential threat of climate change. Critics argued that if climate change was indeed a dire threat, it should be addressed directly and urgently. While the administration did attempt some bold moves, it was unable to secure a comprehensive climate bill. Similarly to Clinton and George H.W. Bush's administrations, the bill rehashed the same cap-and-trade system for limiting emissions. Progressives were underwhelmed, but the bill managed to pass the House in 2009, only to die in the Senate in 2010. From the outside, it was perplexing. On paper, Obama began his term with Democratic control of the Congress. It should have produced a dramatic shift in policymaking, but the necessary margin and luck just wasn't there in reality. The House had a clear Democratic majority with 257 Democrats to 178 Republicans. However, in the Senate, there was a filibuster rule that requires 60 Senate votes to bring any legislation to the floor for amendments and a final vote. Democrats only had 59, including two mostly reliable votes from independents that often sided with Democrats. But the 59 wasn't enough, often leaving legislation that was approved in the House to die in the Senate. Then a bit of musical chairs ensued. Of the 59, Ted Kennedy had a seizure earlier that year and never returned. Al Franken was not officially seated until July 7th due to a highly contested race that was followed with recounts. Republican Senator Arlen Specter became a Democrat in April, increasing the count, but Robert Byrd got sick in May and did not return to the Senate until late July. Ted Kennedy eventually passed away on August 25, 2009, and his seat was not filled until September 24, 2009 by Paul Kirk, finally bringing the Democratic senator count to 60, albeit temporarily. A special vote introduced Republican Scott Brown to officially replace Kennedy's Massachusetts seat on February 4, 2010. So, the Democrats had a four-month window from September 24th to February 4th, 2010 to legislate without partisan resistance. With so much in flux, no direct major climate change action was achieved in that time. Now, one of the most significant yet under-publicized events during President Obama's term was the 2010 Supreme Court decision in Citizens United versus FEC. The case stemmed from the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act of 2002, or BCRA, also known as the McCain-Feingold Act, where a key provision prevented corporations or labor unions from funding political communications within 60 days of a general election and 30 days of a primary election. In 2008, the conservative nonprofit organization Citizens United sought an injunction against the Federal Election Commission, or FEC, who prohibited the broadcast of Hillary the Movie, a documentary that strongly criticized Senator Hillary Clinton, then candidate for the Democratic nomination for president. The U.S. District Court ruled against Citizens United on all counts, citing a 2003 McConnell versus FEC decision about campaign finance regulation. There, the Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of this provision in the BCRA. The film attempted to convince voters that Clinton was unfit for office, so the district court also cited the 2003 Federal Election Commission versus Wisconsin Right to Life, Inc. decision in determining that the film intended to, quote, express advocacy or its functional equivalent, end quote. Now, we've previously covered the history of the Supreme Court and its evolution as a decision-making body. Although important, justice appointments were not the source of great political controversy as they are today. The court saw a conservative shift when President Nixon promised a conservative retrenchment in 1968. Then, in 1986, Ronald Reagan nominated Antonin Scalia.
Today, I received with regret Chief Justice Burger's letter formally notifying me of his retirement. And immediately after my conversation with the Chief Justice, I had directed my Chief of Staff, together with the Attorney General and the Counsel to the President, to develop recommendations for a successor. And I'm pleased to announce my intention to nominate William H. Rehnquist, currently an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, as the new Chief Justice of the United States. Upon Justice Rehnquist's confirmation, I intend to nominate Antonin Scalia, currently a judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, as Justice Rehnquist's successor. In taking this action, I am mindful of the importance of these nominations. The Supreme Court of the United States is the final arbiter of our Constitution and the meaning of our laws. The Chief Justice and the 8 Associate Justices of the Court must not only be just jurists of the highest competence, they must also be attentive to the rights specifically guaranteed in our Constitution and the proper role of the courts in our democratic system. In choosing Justice Rehnquist and Judge...
Scalia was described as the intellectual anchor for the originalist and textualist position in the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative wing. Back in 1981, as a law professor at the University of Chicago, he was the faculty advisor for Chicago's version of the student group that led to the creation of the Federalist Society. At their first meeting, Scalia read a passage from the Federalist Papers, a collection of 85 articles and essays written by Alexander Hamilton, James Madison, and John Jay to promote the ratification of the Constitution of the United States.
The reason of man, like man himself, is timid and cautious when left alone, and acquits firmness and confidence in proportion to the number with which it is associated.
Scalia expressed to the students that intellectual courage is based on strength in numbers. President George W. Bush, when asked about the kind of justices he would appoint to the Supreme Court, responded,
"I would pick people that would be strict constructionists. We've got plenty of lawmakers in Washington, D.C. Legislators make law. Judges interpret the Constitution. And that's the kind of judge I'm going to put on there."
In more detail, he shared that he would nominate judges to the court in the mold of originalist Justice Antonin Scalia. Strict constructionism is used as a political catch-all term for conservative legal philosophies that are more willing to strike down federal laws and regulations that, in their view, exceed the authorities given to them by the Constitution. Leading into the Citizens United versus FEC case, the composition of the Supreme Court had remained unchanged since 1994. That court, led by Chief Justice Rehnquist, was sharply divided on a number of high-profile issues. One or two key justices could completely shift the thinking of the court on such issues. Unexpectedly, Associate Justice Sandra Day O'Connor retired in the summer of 2005. She was a moderate conservative that usually sided with the court's conservative bloc, but she was considered a swing vote and often wrote concurring opinions that limited the reach of the majority holding. That September, her retirement was followed by the death of Chief Justice Rehnquist. The Associate Justice replacement was Samuel Alito, who called himself a practical originalist. The Chief Justice appointment was John Roberts, who is considered a moderate conservative and institutionalist. The problem with Roberts' version of an institutionalist, someone who wants to maintain the credibility of the court, is that he has long appeared to defend the legitimacy of the court no matter what, rather than thus far upholding ethics to prove and maintain credibility. Notably, the share of Americans with a favorable opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court has, under Roberts, declined to its lowest point in the public opinion surveys dating to 1987. Even Republican views of this conservative supermajority are at near lows, only viewed worse during a series of decisions between 2005 and 2018. That new makeup of the Supreme Court agreed to hear Citizens United versus FEC, and despite the previous court's rulings, the court issued a 5-4 decision in favor of Citizens United. And with that decision, corporate spending on electoral campaigns flooded in, exacerbating the influence of the fossil fuel industry in politics. Political power shifted from everyday Americans to wealthy special interests. In 2006, the oil and gas industry spent $22.3 million on federal elections. In 2012, the first election post-Citizens United, that number jumped up to $73.5 million. In 2016, $102.7 million. This single decision made it more challenging to pass climate legislation as politicians became increasingly beholden to their biggest donors rather than public interests. After the 2012 election, and with the economy in recovery, the Obama administration gave more attention to climate policies. President Obama placed 548 million acres of habitat under protection, including Arctic tundra, mountain woodlands, and coral reefs. This was the largest area protected by any president in U.S. history, surpassing the efforts of Theodore Roosevelt. Despite some resistance, such as opposition to the expansion of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, Obama's conservation measures made a significant impact on preserving natural habitats. He rejected the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have transported oil from Canadian tar sands to U.S. refineries, arguing that some fossil fuels should be kept in the ground to combat climate change. A less publicized but significant accomplishment was the development of appliance and equipment standards through the Department of Energy. These standards, which were largely implemented without fanfare or litigation, reduced electricity consumption from various appliances, contributing to long-term reductions in U.S. CO2 emissions. On the international stage, President Obama played a crucial role in brokering the Global Climate Accord during the 2015 United Nations Climate Summit in Paris, finally bringing the U.S. into the global climate fight. He committed the U.S. to reducing emissions by at least 26% below 2005 levels by 2025, and negotiated directly with countries like China to build support for the agreement. For the U.S.'s part, a significant portion of the emission reduction was intended to come from Obama's Clean Power Plan, or CPP, which included the EPA's first standards on carbon dioxide emissions from power plants. However, it was arguably too late in Obama's term. Democrats made a major miscalculation in thinking that the next president would be a Democrat, likely Hillary Clinton, to protect and continue similar policies. The CPP wasn't proposed until June 2014 and finalized in 2015. It would still be under litigation in the next administration, making it vulnerable to being easily overturned, which is exactly what happened. The 2016 presidential general election was a contentious and controversial contest between the Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, and the Republican nominee, Donald Trump. Going into the election, polls largely suggested that Hillary Clinton would be elected. But in a shocking turn of events, Donald Trump, a political outsider, won, becoming the 45th president of the United States.
Now it's time for America to bind the wounds of division. We have to get together. To all Republicans and Democrats and independents across this nation, I say it is time for us to come together as one united people. It's time. I pledge to every citizen of our land that I will be president for all Americans And this is so important to me. For those who have chosen not to support me in the past, of which there were a few people, I'm reaching out to you for your guidance and your help so that we can work together and unify our great country.
Later in his speech, Trump makes a point to thank Reince Priebus, then chairman of the Republican National Committee.
Just tremendous people. A very special person who, believe me, and you know, I'd read reports that I wasn't getting along with him. I never had a bad second with him. He's an unbelievable star. He is, that's right, how did you possibly guess? So let me tell you about Reince. And I've said this. I said, Reince, and I know it. I know it. Look at all those people over there. I know it. Reince is a superstar. But I said, they can't call you a superstar, Reince, unless we win. Because you can't be called a superstar like Secretariat. If Secretariat came in second, Secretariat would not have that big, beautiful bronze bust at the track at Belmont. But I'll tell you, Reince is really a star. And he is the hardest working guy.
And in a certain Priebus was in a wing of the Republican Party tied to the Koch network, who also have a deep connection with Trump's running mate, Mike Pence. Donald Trump went on to select Priebus as his chief of staff. Being a political novice, the Trump campaign had a small staff and was light on policy experience. So the administration leaned heavily on the personnel from the Koch network and the Heritage Foundation during the transition. In fact, the Heritage Foundation has touted its influence over Trump's agenda. The organization said the Trump administration embraced 2/3 of the 334 policy recommendations in its mandate for leadership. Heritage itself cited the efforts of about 70 of its former employees working throughout the transition and administration. Like the Bush administration, hundreds of staffers from lobbying firms, conservative think tanks, and campaign groups began pouring into the very agencies they once lobbied or whose work they once opposed. According to ProPublica, a nonprofit organization based in New York City dedicated to investigative journalism, after a year of filing hundreds of Freedom of Information Act requests, they discovered at least 187 Trump political appointees have been federal lobbyists that went on to oversee the industries they once lobbied on behalf of, and at least 125 staffers from prominent conservative think tanks were working in the federal government. They also discovered ethics waivers that allow staffers to work on subjects in which they had financial conflicts of interest. At least 35 Trump political appointees worked for or consulted with groups affiliated with Charles and David Koch. At least 25 Trump appointees came from the Heritage Foundation, and at least 2 came from Heritage Action, its related political nonprofit. The Trump administration's ties to the Heritage Foundation were quite strong. So much so that after the term, the foundation bolstered its ranks with the addition of 4 members from former President Trump's cabinet, including former Vice President Mike Pence, former Acting Homeland Security Chad Wolf, former Veteran Affairs Secretary Robert L. Wilkie, and former Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Andrew Wheeler. The cabinet cohort was in addition to at least 6 other Trump administration officials who also joined the foundation in 2021. Following the guidance of the Heritage Foundation and Koch brothers, President Donald Trump took office promising a business-friendly deregulation agenda. Shortly after taking office, he issued an executive order that for every new regulation put in place, 2 had to be eliminated. His deregulation agenda extended into the rules that protect air and water quality and address climate change. The Trump administration rolled back more than 100 environmental rules. They immediately replaced Obama's CPP with the Affordable Clean Energy Rule, or ACE, which was touted to focus on improving the efficiency of individual coal-fired plants as the best way to reduce emissions. In contrast, the CPP takes a broader approach, considering how the entire electrical grid operates and includes methods like renewable energy, fuel switching, co-firing, energy efficiency, and emissions trading to reduce emissions. One study revealed that the ACE standard could result in emissions rebound, which occurs when a facility undergoes improvements to increase its efficiency and, as a result, operates longer and more often, leading to increased emissions. The analysis found that 1. The ACE rule is likely to result in even higher national carbon dioxide emissions in 2050 and more harm to public health and ecosystems than the EPA estimated in the final 2019 regulatory impact assessment. 2. The CPP, if updated to reflect recent emissions reductions, would achieve much larger emissions reductions than EPA estimated in its repeal. 3. Emissions reductions under the updated CPP would be robust under shifting market conditions, while emissions under the ACE rule are likely to increase further. The Trump administration also weakened fuel economy standards for cars and light trucks, significantly slowing the progress towards reducing emissions from the transportation sector, the largest source of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. The new standards required only 1.5% annual increase in fuel economy, down from the previous 5% requirement. Additionally, the administration revoked California's ability to set its own stricter fuel economy rules, although this decision faced significant legal challenges. In efforts to revive the coal industry, the Trump administration rolled back regulations on emissions of mercury and other toxic substances from power plants and reduced coal ash disposal and storage regulations. While this was a campaign promise and an effort to bring back coal jobs in the U.S., the coal industry remained in decline due to competition from cheaper energy options like natural gas. President Trump also pulled the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement and worked to open more land for oil and gas leasing by limiting wildlife protections and weakening environmental requirements for projects. These actions prioritize economic benefits over environmental and public health concerns, contributing to increased emissions and environmental degradation. To quantify the impacts of these policy changes, Rhodium Group, an independent research firm that analyzes China's economy and policy dynamics and global climate change and energy systems, estimated the Trump administration's actions could add a total of at least 1.8 billion tons of extra CO2 to the atmosphere by 2035. The rollback of the fuel efficiency standards would add about 450 million tons of CO2. The withdrawal of California's waiver, if upheld, would add about 570 million tons by slowing the transition to electric vehicles. Weaker methane regulations would contribute 640 million tons. Some of the Trump environmental policies were carelessly crafted, open to litigation and easy nullification in the courts. However, the continued evolution of the justice system during his term was another remarkable strike against the environmental movement. Back on February 13, 2016, just under 9 months before the 2016 presidential election, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia died at the age of 79. President Barack Obama had quickly named Merrick Garland to fill the seat. Garland had long been considered a prime prospect for the High Court, serving as Chief Judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, a frequent source of justices, sometimes called the Little Supreme Court. Widely considered moderate, Garland was praised in the past by many Republicans. However, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell withheld the confirmation hearing.
Mr. President, the next justice could fundamentally alter the direction of the Supreme Court and have a profound impact on our country. So, of course, the American people should have a say in the court's direction. It is the president's constitutional right to nominate a Supreme Court justice, and it is the Senate's constitutional right to act as a check on a president and withhold its consent. As Chairman Grassley and I declared weeks ago and reiterated personally to President Obama, the Senate will continue to observe the Biden rule so that the American people have a voice in this momentous decision. The American people may well elect a president who...
Contentious hearings, floor debates, and contested votes were common, but to completely ignore a nomination was unprecedented in the modern era and hasn't been done since the Civil War and Reconstruction. McConnell recognized that this was a massive political play, relishing the action that he understood could reshape America.
One of my proudest moments is when I looked at Barack Obama in the eye and I said, Mr. President, you will not fill this Supreme Court vacancy. So, do we want Jim Gray and Hillary Clinton shaping the Supreme Court? No. Do we want Jim Gray and Hillary Clinton propping up Obamacare? No. Do we want some Jim Gray bobblehead in Congress rubber stamping Hillary's war on coal jobs? No. Then we better not send Jim Gray or Hillary Clinton to Washington. Kentuckians want a conservative Supreme Court and an end to Obamacare, and the only way to get either is to send Donald Trump to the White House and my good friend Rand Paul back to the Senate.
Interestingly, that year, the Senate Leadership Fund, a super PAC run by former aides to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who also previously led a suit to challenge campaign finance regulation, raised an astonishing $39 million in the 3 weeks before the 2016 election. The huge injection of money helped backstop Senate Republicans and protect their majority on Election Day. The gigantic fundraising surge for the Super PAC pushed its total above $100 million, making it one of the best-funded Super PACs of the 2016 election cycle. One oil and gas company, Polar Tankers, Inc., a subsidiary of ConocoPhillips, gave $1 million to the Senate Leadership Fund. When looking specifically at McConnell's donors, research shows that 85% of his funding comes from large organizational donors, mega donors in oil and gas, service industries, military contractors, realtors, and a collection of conservatively branded ideological groups that often turn out to be shells for political operations by other prominent Republicans. But McConnell's earlier stance on letting the American people have a say in filling a justice seat dramatically shifted in 2020. The death of liberal Associate Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg on September 18, 2020, under 2 months from the 2020 election, allowed for another justice appointment, which the Senate quickly confirmed. Now this was it. That weekend at Yale, back in the spring of 1982, all led up to this moment. Including the replacement nominee after the 2018 retirement of Associate Justice Anthony Kennedy, considered a swing vote, the Trump administration would ultimately appoint three Supreme Court justices during his term. He appointed Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Neil Gorsuch, establishing a court where at least five of the nine members were members of the Federalist Society: Brett Kavanaugh, Neil Gorsuch, Clarence Thomas, Samuel Alito, and Amy Coney Barrett. Chief Justice John Roberts was a member of the steering committee of the Washington, D.C. chapter, but denies ever being a member of the Federalist Society. This dramatic ideological shift created a new type of 6-3 conservative supermajority. Even beyond the Supreme Court, President Trump appointed lower federal court judges at a rapid rate. In his first term, he appointed 234 judges, only outpaced by Jimmy Carter with 262. The next highest in a single term is Joe Biden with 206 confirmed and 251 nominated at the time of this recording. Then Franklin D. Roosevelt with 194. Jumping ahead, the transformational impact of the judicial branch can be seen in the 2024 Supreme Court decision in the combined cases of Loperbright Enterprises versus Raymond and Relentless Inc. versus Department of Commerce. The question at the core of both cases was whether the Secretary of Commerce, acting through the National Marine Fisheries Service and following the Magnuson-Stevens Fishery Conservation and Management Act, could require commercial fishers to pay for onboard observers whom they are required to take on some fishing voyages. Specifically, the plaintiffs were challenging a near 40-year-old doctrine of federal administrative law known as the Chevron deference, which is based on the 1984 holding from Chevron USA, Inc. versus Natural Resources Defense Council, Inc. Congress routinely enacts open-ended laws that allow agencies to work out and adjust the details based on new facts and findings. The precedent of the Chevron ruling established that courts defer to federal agencies when creating regulations based on ambiguous law. Interestingly, the 1984 Chevron case stemmed from Neil Gorsuch's mother, Ann Gorsuch, former Environmental Protection Agency administrator under the Reagan administration, who was forced to step down over misconduct within the EPA. Gorsuch's EPA issued a rule that was challenged by environmental groups for not being aggressive enough on polluters. The case went to the Supreme Court, where the decision was unanimous. However, back in the 1980s, Gorsuch's EPA aimed to weaken pollution standards, so the ruling was seen as a defeat for environmentalists. Notably, by Ann's later account, after she resigned, her son Neil was furious. He told her,
"You should never have resigned. You didn't do anything wrong. You only did what the president ordered. Why are you quitting? You raised me not to be a quitter. Why are you a quitter?"
A Harvard Law School classmate of Neil's also shared,
"He viewed his mother as an environmentalist, and his mother viewed herself as an environmentalist. And meanwhile, she was made the poster child of the view that the Reagan administration was just out there to rape the environment."
By most accounts, he did not dwell on it later in life, but it did seem to echo in his work. Another Harvard classmate recalled that while preparing a moot court brief on workplace safety, he tried to add material concerning the EPA that did not fit. In his time as an appeals court judge in Denver, his most notable writings have concerned the power of government regulators. So, in a full circle moment, Neil Gorsuch joined a 6-3 ruling that overturned the 1984 decision. This time, environmentalists are concerned about what a Supreme Court steeped in originalist doctrine will do. Chief Justice John Roberts wrote in his majority opinion that federal agencies, quote, "have no special competence in resolving statutory ambiguities. Courts do." He continued, quote, "Courts must exercise their independent judgment in deciding whether an agency has acted within its statutory authority," end quote. Between 2022 and 2024, the Supreme Court issued several rulings that significantly restricted EPA authority. Other key decisions include striking down the EPA's Good Neighbor Rule, which regulated cross-state smokestack pollution, rejected the Waters of the United States Rule, designed to protect wetlands, and in 2022, the court limited the EPA's ability to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants under the CPP. These decisions have undermined the EPA's capacity to enforce environmental regulations and may hinder future administrations from implementing new rules to combat pollution and climate change. This is just the beginning effects of the shift in the judicial branch that the Trump administration enacted. But in the last year of his presidency, everything came to a halt. On February 11, 2020, the World Health Organization, or WHO, named a disease that was rapidly traversing the globe, COVID-19. The effect of the virus is an acute lung and respiratory distress syndrome that can ultimately cause pulmonary failure and death in some of the population. The virus is transmitted through contact with respiratory droplets that are expelled by a person suffering from the illness. Cases were spreading rapidly around the world, and subsequently deaths. By March 11th, everything was upended.
Now to growing concerns about the deadly coronavirus officially hitting the U.S. Here's what we know. A Washington State resident fell ill after returning from Wuhan, China, where the outbreak began.
Officials now say more than coronavirus. The World Health Organization has officially called it COVID-19. Co for corona, vi for virus, d for disease, and 19.
We have therefore made the assessment that COVID-19 can be characterized as a pandemic. To do more.
Pandemic. From this evening, I must give the British people a very simple instruction. You must stay at home. Because the critical thing you must do
is sobering milestone, a once unimaginable number. President Biden now marking 1 million lives lost here in the U.S. to COVID. Behind every number is a loved one lost, a family changed forever.
The WHO officially declared the global health emergency a pandemic. The stock market reacted quickly as the Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped more than 1,200 points. Celebrities like Tom Hanks and his wife Rita Wilson amplified the reality of the situation as they announced that they were sick. Shortly before an NBA tip-off, the Jazz's Rudy Gobert and Donovan Mitchell tested positive for the coronavirus. The game was postponed, but soon news broke that the NBA officially suspended the entire season until further notice. Over the following weeks, the world slowly shut down. Businesses closed their doors and non-essential workers stayed home in an attempt to slow the spread of COVID-19. While the U.S. government's initial response left much to be desired and the catastrophic loss of human life that occurred was heartbreaking, the global shutdown provided insight into how resilient the planet could be. Reduced industrial human activity lowered emissions and improved air and water quality. Studies have shown the decline in daily CO2 emissions peaked at just over 20% in the largest economies. The cumulative reduction in global emissions was approximately 7% from January through April 2020. From March 16th to April 14th, 2020, 22 cities in India had a reduction in particulate matter, PM10, by 43%, PM2.5, by 31%, carbon monoxide by 10%, and nitrogen dioxide by 18%. Solid waste from industrial and construction activities was also reduced during the crisis. Several reports indicated a decrease in municipal, industrial, commercial, and gray water waste during the pandemic. Increased green areas and less soil erosion were also observed. Migratory birds were returning to lakes and bodies of water more. Researchers could see the difference in how birds communicate. They could fly freely without human interference. Fishing activity stopped, so dolphins came closer to shore. Coyotes, normally timid, were found near the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. Deer were seen pasturing near homes just a few miles away from the White House. Italy, Barcelona, and Bergamo witnessed wild boar exploring previously populated areas. The environmental recovery was brief, but it illuminated the potential of sustained systemic changes to address environmental challenges. Unfortunately, the most profound legacy of the Trump administration and this era of politics in general will make climate action much more difficult going forward.
Americans were scared, though, I guess. Nearly 200 dead, 14,000 who are sick, millions, as you witness, who are scared right now. What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say.
I mean, I have a mask right here. I
put a mask on, you know, when I think I need it. I don't wear masks like him. Every time you see him, he's got a mask. He could be speaking 200 feet away from it. He shows up with the biggest mask I've ever seen.
Trump also shared a tweet claiming that masks aren't about public health, but social control, and that the image of Joe Biden wearing one endorses a culture of silence, slavery, and social torment.
Crooked Hillary. Crooked Hillary, fuck.
I don't respond to Donald Trump and his string of insults.
She's been crooked from the beginning.
He can say whatever he wants to say about me.
To explain his rigged election prediction.
The election is being rigged by corrupt media pushing false allegations and outright lies in an effort to elect Hillary Clinton president.
Over the weekend,
from our perspective, there is amazing partnership on the ground, and there needs to be. As the governor said, we've had temperatures explode this summer. You may have learned that we broke a world record in the Death Valley, 130 degrees. But even in greater LA, 120 plus degrees. And we're seeing this warming trend make our summers warmer, but also our winters warmer as well. So I think one area of mutual agreement and priority is vegetation management. But I think we want to work with you to really recognize the changing climate and what it means to our forests and actually work together with that science. That science is going to be key. Because if we ignore that science and sort of put our head in the sand and think it's all about vegetation management, we're not going to succeed together protecting Californians.
Okay. It'll start getting cooler.
You just watch. I wish science agreed with you.
Hey, well, I don't think science knows, actually. Tom, please.
Mr. President, if you...
There was and continues to be a significant assault on institutions and science, likely increasing climate denialism and resistance to climate action due to a growing lack of trust in anything. The pandemic highlighted the Trump administration's disregard for scientific advice, as seen in the politicization of public health responses. This further eroded public trust in science and demonstrated the dangers of undermining scientific expertise and policymaking. With hundreds of political appointees with ties to lobbying firms, conservative think tanks, and industries they once lobbied for, placed in key positions within federal agencies, there was widespread censorship of scientific information, particularly related to climate change. Federal scientists faced suppression of their work, leading to a culture of self-censorship and a decline in public trust in scientific institutions. During President Trump's time in office, including the transition period, there were 154 documented instances of federal government censorship of scientists and 19 instances of scientists engaging in self-censorship even before President Trump officially took office. Approximately 72% involved the suppression of information about climate change. In November 2016, staff at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC, deleted content discussing the relationship between climate change and human health from at least 4 web pages, reportedly to, quote, avoid the new president's ire, end quote. Similar changes were made after President Trump took office. In total, during the Trump administration, climate change and other scientific information was removed from websites of 12 federal bodies, in most cases at the direction of administration officials. The Trump administration also removed scientific information from regulatory documents. This helped the administration advance its deregulatory agenda, including by casting doubt on the need for climate regulations. Trump administration officials also attempted to suppress information that could lead to demands for stricter regulation. A survey conducted in 2016 before President Trump's election found that 72% of scientists felt they could, quote, openly express scientific opinions about the agency's scientific work without fear of retaliation, end quote. That number dropped to just 57% in a repeat survey conducted in 2018. Over 600 of the scientists surveyed in 2018 said their, quote, management change do not consistently stand behind scientific staff who put forth scientifically defensible positions, including those that may be controversial, end quote. Both self and government censorship may have contributed to public mistrust in federal scientists and lead some to believe that such research is inherently political and thus untrustworthy. But in 2020, Donald Trump's second bid for the presidency was denied, as Joe Biden was elected the 46th president of the United States.
Folks, the people of this nation have spoken. They've delivered us a clear victory, a convincing victory, a victory for we the people. We've won with the most votes ever cast on a presidential ticket in the history of the nation, 74 million. What I must admit has surprised me. Tonight, we're seeing all over this nation, all cities and all parts of the country, indeed across the world, an outpouring of joy, of hope, renewed faith in tomorrow, bring a better day.
The Biden administration took a proactive stance on climate policy, aiming to reverse many of Trump's rollbacks and implement ambitious new measures. Key initiatives included rejoining the Paris Agreement, setting a net zero emissions goal for the U.S. by 2050, and introducing comprehensive climate legislation through the Inflation Reduction Act. By rejoining the Paris Agreement, Biden sought to restore U.S. credibility in global climate leadership, encouraging other nations to enhance their climate commitments. The administration's most significant policy was the Inflation Reduction Act, which, despite its title, contained crucial measures to address climate change. This included tax policies to reduce carbon emissions, promote renewable energy, and improve energy efficiency. The Inflation Reduction Act aimed to transition the U.S. away from fossil fuels, penalize companies for excess methane emissions, and allocate funds for pollution cleanup. Although the bill easily passed in the House behind a Democratic majority, it faced challenges in the divided Senate, requiring all Democratic votes, including those of Senators Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin. Sinema objected to tax break reform for private equity and venture capital income, while Manchin, a known fossil fuel ally, expressed concerns about the bill's costs and its aggressive transition to clean energy. Manchin, with ties to the coal industry and financial backing from ExxonMobil, was a critical figure in the negotiations. In the undercover investigation from our previous episode, Keith McCoy, Senior Director of Federal Relations at ExxonMobil, provided additional insight.
Joe Manchin, I talk to his office every week. He is the kingmaker, and he's not shy about sort of staking his claim early and completely changing the debate.
McCoy identified other senators that were key to Exxon's efforts. Republican senators Shelley Moore Capito, John Barrasso, Steve Daines, John Cornyn, and Marco Rubio. Democratic senators Chris Coons, John Tester, and of course, Kyrsten Sinema. McCoy also mentioned Democratic Senators Maggie Hassan and Mark Kelly, but they were the only two that had not accepted money from Exxon or its partners at the time. Through its political connections, Exxon pushes to limit the climate aspects of legislation.
So that's a completely different conversation. When you start to stick to roads and bridges, and instead of a $2 trillion bill, it's an $800 billion bill, if you lower that threshold, you stick to highways and bridges, then a lot of the negative stuff starts to come out. Why would you put in something on emissions reductions on climate change to oil refineries in a highway bill? So, and people say, yeah, that doesn't make any sense. So you get to the germanists saying that shouldn't be in this bill.
Despite initial opposition, negotiations with Sinema and Manchin succeeded, although it led to a narrower version of the Inflation Reduction Act. Nevertheless, the act spurred a surge in clean energy projects across the U.S., with billions invested and hundreds of thousands of jobs created. It also provided tax credits for electric vehicles and clean energy technologies, and emphasized environmental justice to address climate change's impacts on vulnerable communities. Additionally, the Biden administration pushed for increased corporate transparency regarding climate risk. The Securities and Exchange Commission introduced a rule requiring publicly traded companies to disclose carbon emissions, climate-related risks, and strategies to address climate impacts. This measure aimed to provide investors with critical information to hold corporations accountable. However, Biden's climate agenda has faced significant challenges, including political opposition, legal battles, and economic pressures, and the lasting effects of Trump's deregulation, diminished public trust in science, and continued corporate opposition posed ongoing hurdles for environmental protection.
The bottom line is it's going to take political courage, political will, in order to get something done. And that doesn't exist in politics, it just doesn't.
At the time of this recording, we are approaching what appears to be a tight race for the 2024 presidential election in the United States. It's clear the next administration will have a pivotal role in shaping the environmental conditions that the rest of us will inherit and must live through. Good, bad, or indifferent. So now what? I'll highlight where we are today, what's at stake, and how exactly we move forward next time on the finale of Going Green.
They don't stop. Climate change, allegedly, is everywhere. And if the American people elect a conservative president, his administration will have to eradicate climate change references from absolutely everywhere. Population growth, environmental changes, and weather patterns have all been intertwined by the left. They take or even make up a term and create, extend, and alter the definition to validate whatever ideology or position they want to ingrain and convince others is good, when in reality it's not. Often, as you just heard, they are simply not coherent or logical. Remember, our intelligence community identified climate change as the number one threat to America. So even if you do not work at the Department of Energy, no matter where you work, because of the Biden administration's executive orders and policy priorities, you will have to look for climate change language and get rid of it.
Thanks for listening. Going Green is a Spaces podcast story brought to you by Lines. If you learned something from this episode or think it would resonate with a friend, please share it and rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. It really helps others find the show. If you have a question, want to submit a correction, or just share whatever is on your mind, I'd love to hear from you. You can do that at lines.studio/podcast. That's lynes.studio/podcast, and listen in to my wrap-up episode to hear my response. If you're looking for similar content, Spaces is a proud member of Gable Media, a digital media platform where you can find even more content like this. Visit gablemedia.com, that's gablemedia.com. And before I go, if you want to see additional photos, videos, clips, and other content that I found during my research, you can visit lines.studio/podcast. Talk soon.